From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in 1873 on a canvas when a New York painter named Jay Whitehorn was completing the portrait of a man. The oil on canvas painting was probably a source of pride for the man. We don't know his name or his story, but we do know that the Memorial Art Gallery, or the Meg, in Rochester, picked up the painting in May 1958. Those 85 years in between are a big question mark. Question marks take the symbol of a T at the Memorial Art Gallery. T items are temporary items. They aren't owned by the Meg, and they aren't part of the museum's collection. And the Meg staff doesn't know who their true owners are, even after years of analysis. The portrait of a man is one of more than 600 temporary or mystery items at the Meg. There are sculptures, etchings, parts of musical instruments, textiles, the list goes on and on. This story first came to our attention after Democrat and Chronicle columnist Dave Andreotta visited the Meg and wrote about those objects and a new state law that helps museums manage undocumented or unclaimed items. We decided we wanted to check out the items for ourselves, and you can see some photos of them on my Twitter feed. That's at MMacMedia. We'll be talking about those items throughout the hour, so be sure to take a look. Maybe one of the photos will jog your memory. Maybe you'll find a long-lost family heirloom. The Meg needs your help. So if you're missing a dulcimer, some pieces of a flute, or maybe a colonial South American bookstand, you may reconnect with them soon. My guests for the hour are from the Meg, and they'll help us understand these mystery items, and we'll talk about their future. Our sleuths in studio today include Jess Martin, the curator in charge and curator of American art at the Memorial Art Gallery. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Nancy Norwood is the curator of European art at the Meg. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Carrie Schauber is the curatorial research assistant at the Meg, and she's the one that helped help us take a look at those items last week it was. Thanks for joining us, Carrie.
Thanks.
Now, Carrie, you are really doing detective work.
I am.
We followed you down a maze of rooms in the Meg to look at some of those tea items. And we'll walk through the process of trying to track down information about the items in just a few minutes. But first, how many items were considered mystery items before you began this process?
There are almost, the numbers are sequential, starting with T1. And right now we're up to almost T800. So over time there have been almost 800. And now we're down to 600 and something. So 200 and change have been knocked off along the way, not all by me, but over the years.
How many years have you been working on this tea project? Can we call it that?
Yeah, that's what we call it. I've been working on it intensively for maybe 2 years or 2.5 years. But I've been working at the Meg as the research assistant for more than 10 years, and so I've been picking them off as I can, you know, just as I find information in the files or can match things up. I would just knock off one or two as information arose.
When we were doing our tour and when you were showing us some of the items, you said you like bringing order to chaos.
That's true.
So this is fun for you. It's fun to go in every day.
It is.
With
it is.
All these question marks.
And I know that it's fun to resolve the question marks, not to have the question mark.
That's fair. And you did have one big success story, which I'm sure was exciting.
Did.
We tweeted a picture of that. So let's talk, before we go through any of the big mysteries, let's give our listeners hope and know that despite the fact that there are 600 of these items still waiting to be claimed or documented, there is one that has been a big success that you can see on my Twitter feed.
That's true.
Go ahead, Carrie.
There was a black and white wood and ivory inlay chest that was in storage with an incorrect accession number on it. So when we determined that it was the incorrect number, we tagged it with a T number so that we could track it in our database. And subsequently, maybe a year later or more, I just happened to find a letter in a file of correspondence where our director in 1960 had written to a scholar in New York City asking for information about a chest that had just been offered with scenes from the Trojan War and from classical antiquity.
Oh.
And I thought, boy, that sounds familiar. I think I've seen that. So I checked our photos of the chest, and sure enough, there were photos from the images from the Trojan War and classical antiquity. So then I had a date that the object had come in because our director said that he had just been offered recently at that time. So I went back to our art committee minutes, which is the subset of MAG's board, which has to approve any accessions and deaccessions from the collection. And I looked around that time, and in the fall of 1959, I found it in the records that the chest had been offered and accepted, but we had never done the documentation at that time to give it an accession number, enter it in the logbook, or to, you know, make a proper file for it or any of that. So we just presented it at Art Committee last week for a formal acceptance, and it was happily accepted at that meeting. And so now it's got an accession number, and it's a real boy.
Well, and it's a real treasure, mm-hmm. too. It's a German 16th century, late 16th century chest, and it's fantastic. I've sent photos to scholars, colleagues in Europe, and they're all like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. So we've had it, just needed a little conservation, and we'll be putting it on view very soon. But it's wonderful to have it, and I'm really excited, and Carrie did a great job on that one. So.
And it is a beautiful chest, and I know this is radio, so our listeners can't see what it looks like. You can check my Twitter feed at mmacmedia, but for those who aren't on social media, can you describe, Nancy, what it looks like? There are so many intricate details, and it opens up in interesting ways.
Well, it's actually a writing chest, and so it closes up to be an ebonized box with ivory little pieces on the outside. And then when you fold it down, there's very, very beautiful inset etched ivory with these scenes that derive from printmaking at the time that do illustrate the Trojan War. But it was used, and there are lots of little compartments and drawers, and these were called Kunstkammer, or art collection things. So people would put pens and jewelry and writing implements, and they would actually take these with them when they traveled sometimes. So
that's a big chest, though, to drag around with you.
Well, it is, but people took their tapestries with them, too.
Oh,
so,
my.
I mean, it's not like they put it in the back of their car.
That's fair. Nancy, all of you, what does it feel like to have one of those success stories, to finally say, yes, we know what this is? I'm sure it gives you motivation to keep going.
That's exactly it. It makes you feel like you are going to match one up once in a while if you just look in the right place and look hard enough and long enough. And, you know, maybe some piece of paper will turn up in a file somewhere that you've looked at 15 times, and you'll be able to make the match, and you'll have some resolution.
What do these files look like? Is it piles and piles of papers, or is it very organized where you can look by year? Just help us understand what you walk into.
There are drawers of donor records, correspondence, and lists and things that are organized alphabetically by the donor's name. And those have been digitized now. We've transcribed them into a Word document so that it's searchable. So if we're looking for a particular object, we can just search through a Word document for, you know, either someone's name or what kind of object, and hopefully we can make a match. There are the Art Committee minutes are filed by year in our archive, so those are pretty easy to find if you're looking for a specific date. But then there are kind of random drawers and boxes and piles of correspondence that have come from our registrar's office and our previous curator's office, and they contain a wide variety of things, and you never know what you're going to find, whether it pertains to something in the collection or something maybe that was offered but never wound up coming to the collection. Or that's part of what I've been doing is we've had some longtime MAG staff retire over the last 5 years or so, and I wind up with boxes of stuff to papers to go through. So that's part
what
of how
a gift.
It is. It's really fun. That's part of how I'm making the matches, is going through those old letters and lists and memos and trying to match them up with objects.
Mm-hmm. So Carrie is just so good at it that we often say, well, if you don't know what to do with that, pass it on to Carrie and she'll sort it out. But I think most of the mysteries that you've been able to kind of sort out are that correspondence that doesn't have a logical home. It doesn't necessarily relate to a specific object that's in our collection that we would have a file or a record for. So they end up in these kind of limbo, in between places. And sometimes those are the best sources for digging out those kind of mysteries that have not yet been solved.
Mm-hmm. How do these items get to the Meg? So we can talk about specific individual items, and maybe you know more about others than certain ones, but these are not items that are owned by the museum. They have come there for whatever reason. What are the common reasons that they've ended up at the Meg?
Gosh, there's so many. As many as you can imagine would be, you know, what we could offer. A lot of them are tied to, or were tied to, probably specific exhibitions that might have been held in the past. They might have been offered gifts. That the tricky thing is, you know, before the internet, before, you know, phone calls were easy to make, or curators and the director would receive these gifts, these offered gifts, and in order to really determine if the museum would want them for the collection, it would take some research. Like Carrie was saying, the letter in 1960 the director sent to a scholar in New York about, you know, is this something that we might want for the collection? A lot of times a letter like that might be sent with a Polaroid or a photo in it, and sometimes the letter would be answered and sometimes it wouldn't. So in the instance where a letter wasn't answered, that object might kind of sit around and just remain in limbo long enough so that it might become one of these mystery objects, you know, 50, 60, 70 years down the line.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think they ever walked into the Meg and said, I have this thing that I think is valuable or is, you know, you might want it. Can I just leave it here and you tell me? Was it like an antiques roadshow kind of thing?
Actually, people still try to do that.
Oh.
And one reason we discourage it in terms of people just stopping in with things is because we don't want things to wind up without any documentation. And it would be very easy to do if someone stops in and says, I just want you to look at it. Can you leave this here? Or can I leave this here? I mean, we ask them to come back and make an appointment so that we can really have a paper trail for everything that walks in the door now. But the museum's over 100 years old, and things have changed a lot in the museum world. I think a lot of those objects, we were talking about it yesterday, and I think a lot of them could have come in, you know, they did period rooms at the time, and maybe, who knows, maybe those dulcimers were props almost that were used. We don't really do that now, but, I mean, 100 years is a long time, so.
And I think once something comes into our art storage rooms, it's sort of like the great equalizer. Once an object is in our art storage room, we are responsible for treating it as though it were a collection object, as though it were something on loan to us. So so that's a good thing, but it's also sort of increases the responsibility on these objects that are of lesser import or are not technically actually ours. So everything we treat as though it were a Monet or as though it were, you know, one of our most cherished objects in our collection.
So one of those items that Carrie had a chance to show us was a book stand that's wood, and it's very delicate. There are pieces that are falling off of it. Right, and you haven't figured out who the owner is of that yet. You may never know. Can you work to preserve or conserve that, or because it's not owned by the Meg, you're not allowed to try to improve the condition? Are there laws about that?
I don't think there are any laws about it. It's not something we would probably prioritize in terms of our limited conservation funds. We do, if something is broken, we do, if there's like fragments, we bag them, we keep them with the object, they're labeled. If something shouldn't be sitting on a shelf on its own, it's boxed, it's treated. As Jess said, it's, you know, all of our children are equal, really. So it's cared for, but it's a little bit in limbo, like most of these objects, until we figure out. And that's why this 2008 law was so great, because it allows these things to eventually find a home, a real home.
So that's why you're putting ads in City Newspaper. You're on the program today trying to find the homes of these items. Let's talk about that law. So passed in 2008, and it gives the state's museums a process to establish ownership of undocumented collections, long-forgotten loans, doorstep donations that you were describing, Nancy. And this is something that the Meg is now invoking for the first time.
Right.
Did you see how many items you had and thought, we're running out of space, we need to try to figure out what to do with these? Or what was the impetus for this process?
it really is about that, you know, everything that comes into that space we're caring for. And museum art storage is precious and limited. And so we really want to make sure that we're spending our resources on objects that are a priority for us. So the 240 or so objects that were listed in City, that's really our first round of objects that we'll be listing. And there's a whole process that you have to undergo. So they were listed for 3 weeks in some newspaper. We chose the City. General interest newspaper. And then we have to wait 180 days to see if we get any responses from the public. And then after that 180 days, it goes to the New York State
Comptroller's website to be listed for,
another 180 days.
We have to wait for another 180 days after that. So it's like a year process all told.
Right. So this really, this is our first round. We anticipate that we'll eventually do all 600 or so of those objects that might remain or anything else we might find between now and then. And, you know, it's now 2017. The law was enacted in 2008. Really, a lot of what was happening in between was research, was us really doing the due diligence research to be certain that the objects that we're listing, we just can't figure out where they're from. Carrie has dug in all of her locations and looked in all of her spots and hasn't been able to figure out where they're from. So this is now our next step.
When did the ad go out in City newspaper?
November 1st.
Oh, okay.
It was the first.
Okay,
listing.
So it hasn't been out that long. Have you had any responses?
We didn't have any responses from the actual ad running. We had 4 or 5 calls after the DNC article, but none of them were about specific objects that had been listed in that ad. There were more general inquiries about, you know, my grandmother once lent a such and such, and I would look up, you know, what I could look up and tell them whatever information I could find, but they weren't particularly about the objects we had listed.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic that you will have some calls that may lead you to some information?
Ooh.
We hope so.
Yeah, I mean, we would love to.
We like success stories. I mean, I think that we would love to have some success stories from this, but we don't anticipate it.
Mm. Okay. Where can people find the ad? Say they're listening and maybe they're thinking, oh, my grandmother dropped something off in, you know, 1915.
It was online at the City newspaper's site for that 3 weeks, but it's not.
Is it no longer?
It's not.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, anyone who has an inquiry is welcome to contact us at the museum, and we can talk through any questions they have or, you know, dig in a little bit deeper on whatever sort of documentation we may have.
So say you get a call. Someone says, I saw the ad. I think this is my item. How do you determine proof of ownership? What does that process look like?
The terminology in the ad is that they need to provide document proof of ownership or evidence of ownership. Mm. So they would need to have not only like a photo of this painting in grandma's living room, but some documentation about it leaving grandma's living room, you know, because grandma could have given it to us herself and that would be perfectly legit. So, I'm not sure what we would really require. I mean,
we are very lucky that we're a part of the University of Rochester, and so we rely on U of R legal counsel a lot for some of these sort of, you know, legal questions, and we would, you know, definitely call in that expertise. But we, you know, a lot of the things that are on these lists, you know, we are not necessarily eager to bring these into the collection. And if, you know, there were opportunities to reunite them with a family that maybe had brought them in for a loan or for expertising or something like that, that would be great. Yeah.
What happens to the items if no one claims them after the year that the ads have been posted and you don't want them as part of the collection? What happens to them next?
Well, we don't quite know exactly what we want to do with all of these. And we haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about these things in particular because we just wanted to see where this process took us. And there are definitely some things that we will not want for the collection. There may be some things that we do want for the collection. And we just haven't gotten to that place yet. But once we do technically own them, then we could make a decision about that. We can decide whether or not we wanted to keep them for our permanent collection, in which case we would sort of enact that whole process that is required in order to accession something into the permanent collection. That would require research. We'd be looking at things like condition. We would be considering whether or not it's a fit for our collection if we have the context to exhibit it and to use it. What else might we do? We might
transfer it to the education collection or to RMSC or another institution, if there's another institution that seems more appropriate for it.
Yeah, for example, the dulcimers.
Let's talk about that. So there's a picture of that on the Twitter feed. And tell us about what you know about that. I know we don't know a whole lot about these objects, but we did know a few things about the dulcimer.
Yeah, I think, Carrie, you probably have the best.
We have two dulcimers that look like they were probably made by the same hand, and one of them conveniently has a label inside saying who the maker was, who is Homer Ledford, who was a musical instrument maker in Kentucky, I believe. And also, conveniently, Homer Ledford has a website where his ledger is transcribed or reproduced, so you can find the catalog number or item number, whatever it was called, which is written on this label inside the dulcimer, and it tells you when it was made and who it was sold to originally. So we know that this one dulcimer that has the label, which is at MAG now, was made in 1968, and it was sold to NYU. But how and why it came at some point to MAG, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. But those are items that would have interest outside of a MAG context. I mean, we're not really actively collecting musical instruments, but other places are, and maybe even in town, you know, if we could find a happy home for it here in Rochester, Eastman, or, you know, that would be great.
Yeah, for example, there was a piano in the collection that we did transfer to Eastman's Gift. It's a 19th century piano, and we really have no use for a 19th century piano in the context of our mission. So we did transfer it to Eastman School of Music, where it does have a great home among other historic instruments. Another thing we do, if something's in poor condition but would be a great learning opportunity for a conservation student, we do transfer things free of charge to conservation training programs. So we've done that with works that we've removed from the collection that are actually in terrible condition, and I'm sure we would do that, you know, that are, just aren't really salvageable for us, but would be a great opportunity for a student. So we try to find the best, as Jess said, we try to find the best home for that particular object. It's not just sort of a cleaning house thing.
Mm-hmm. So if the owner of this dulcimer never becomes known, what are the goals for this piece? Is this something that the MAG would consider for the collection, or is this something that might be a better fit somewhere else?
I mean, I think it's a great object. I don't know that it really is a great fit for MAG. And so, I mean, we would probably reach out to our Rochester colleagues and see if there was any interest there. I saw that there's a Homer Ledford Festival. Like, it's the fifth year running in September of 2017, I saw online.
In Kentucky?
It's in Kentucky, yeah. Okay. So I just saw that yesterday, and I was thinking, while there clearly is a great deal of interest in this, he was a bluegrass musician as well as an instrument maker. Hmm. So, you know, there's interest in his work beyond MAG, and so it's about finding the right home for it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the book stand that I mentioned briefly earlier. This is a beautiful but very delicate wooden book stand. Carrie, tell us a little bit about what you know about that.
We know next to nothing about it. There was a note with it in storage, a sticky note from a previous curator that guessed that it was South American colonial, and date. I don't think a date was on there at all. It might be 19th century, but the style is kind of, I mean, it could be a lot of things, and he could have been wrong about South American colonial. So there's really nothing solid known about it.
When you're looking through some of these items and you find just a post-it note, do you get frustrated? Do you get angry? Are you cursing the people that came before you, thinking, why didn't you take better notes? Why didn't you keep better records?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my goal at MAG is that the person who's me in 100 years should not be cursing my name for our documentation, yep. You know?
We always say that.
But on the other hand, if, you know, it gives me sort of a foot in the door of where to start looking. If somebody who has a good eye looked at this 25 years ago and thought it was this or that, that gives me an idea of where to start looking or how to start describing this object that I might be able to match it up with something down the line.
Or even a reference for how long it's been in storage, if the little note is dated,
if you recognize the handwriting.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, go ahead, Nancy. Sorry.
And also, our resources are so much greater now. Mm. We have a collections management database that we've had for almost 20 years, and where we track, you know, an object's movement from day to day. If you move it to a shelf, it's tracked that way. So there's really much, and there's this way we can also track these tea objects in a real data-based way, as opposed to just little notes and things. I mean, we're very fortunate. We're working in the time we're working. It's just a lot easier to deal with 13,000 objects now than it was before. And we actually have a mid-sized collection. I mean, imagine the Met or Brooklyn. I mean, everyone has this situation with their collections. Everyone has undocumented objects. And, you know, I think we're all now just beginning to, in New York State anyway, beginning to be able to deal with it. So,
some of the easiest success stories were the ones where there was just an incorrect accession number written onto an object. And at some point, you know, 25 years ago, someone went to match it up with our ledger and said, no, that's not the right number. So they just popped a T number on it temporarily, and it turns out once you have the database and you can kind of look at similar numbers, there are maybe only one number off, which was easy for me to figure out now, but not so easy to figure out if you had to run your finger down every page of a ledger or look through our index cards or whatever predated our database. So those were some easy ones that got matched up pretty quickly.
Listeners, if you have questions about any of these mystery items at the MAG, or maybe you think something might belong to you, you can give the program a call. It's 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email your questions or comments to the program at connections@wxxi.org, or you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia, and that's also where you can see some of these great pictures that we were able to take at the MAG of these objects. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the individual objects themselves. Maybe you'll recognize something. Maybe it belongs to your family. We'll also talk about some standout items that our guests may think are there, and we'll also talk more about how museums acquire items. So lots more connections next. Stay with us. I'm Megan Mack. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're talking about artificial intelligence. We'll go deep into AI with some local researchers, and here's why. These are some recent headlines. The solution to our education crisis might be AI. Or how about this one? AI does not have enough experience to handle the next market crash. So what's next for us in AI? How will it help in our future? We'll talk about it. That's Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about mystery items at the Memorial Art Gallery. More than 600 items that don't have owners, don't have documentation, raising a lot of questions at the MAG. And during the break, my guest and I were talking about how museums work, how they acquire items, and some of the misconceptions that people might have. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. So Jess Martin is the curator in charge at the MAG. Jess, what do you think people need to know about how museums work behind the scenes?
Well, there's a lot to know, and I think that there's a lot that's not seen. So I don't have any real specific points to share. You know, museums can acquire things a whole number of different ways. They can come in as a purchase. It can be a very directed decision. The museum will dedicate funds to acquire an object that fulfills a need for the collection. They could be a gift. They could be given by gift, or
it can be given by bequest. It can be transferred. There's all sorts of ways things come in, and but in a way, the processes should always be the same, is that we assess it from the beginning as to whether it's going to fit the collection. Are we going to keep it? Are we going to display it? what its condition is. For when we acquire an object, especially when we purchase it, we have to do a justification. And everything that comes into the collection is not only brought by the director or the curators, but it's also approved by the board. So there's a lot of thought that goes in. It can take months. I think some people in their generosity really want to give us something. They don't realize that it's going to take time for this to move through the wheels. But that's always part of, it's really a good thing. So we don't bring things in that then 2 years later we say, but you know, this isn't really going to fit the mission. It's a great thing. It was great in your family, but maybe it's not so great at MAG. So we try to avoid that as much as possible now. But yeah, those are the basic ways things come in.
And we're trying to keep in mind what the museum wants and needs now, but also maybe what the museum will want and need in 100 years, which is, you know, a big thing to consider. And so it does take a lot of time. And we, you know, really sort of go through the process with care and consideration for every object that comes in, because once it's in the doors, we're taking care of it.
How many objects do you acquire a year, do you think?
Gosh, that's a good question. It really does fluctuate. Some years it can be, depending upon if we, when Isabel Hurdle, who was one of the first curators, her father was the first director of the museum. When she passed away in 2005, I think it was, yes, we received pretty much her entire estate. And so in 2005, there are hundreds of accessioned objects that came in that year. And then some years it can be, you know, less than 100 or, you know, yeah.
30.
Yeah, it really depends.
Mm-hmm. And you could always tell when there was, say, a very large bequest. So in 1955, we received a bequest from a woman named Bertha Buswell, who collected European decorative arts and paintings. And I think there's 260 1955 objects. So I don't know if your listeners know, like if you're in the museum and you're looking at a label on the wall, there'll be a number, and say it's 55.132. That means that the object came into the collection in 1955, and it was the 132nd of that year. So you can always, visitors can always see kind of when something entered the collection, too.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so it's, and most museums have that system, at least museums in the United States. So, yeah, it's a good thing to know. So when we talk about accession numbers, that's what they refer to. Mm-hmm.
So that was 1955. Let's jump ahead 3 years to when the MAG acquired that portrait of a man. Mm-hmm. We don't know much about this man. And I have to say, mm-hmm, this item stood out to me because it made me sad. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's something that, Carrie, we talked about. This person who was, you said, probably an upper-class American, took some pride in having his portrait taken. His family was probably impressed and proud. And now no one knows who this person is.
Yes, it's very sad.
So what do we know about this item? There must be. You recently found a few things.
There is writing on the back of the canvas, which has more recently been covered with a backing board, so it's not visible. It wasn't visible when you were here last week, but we had notes on it that says it's by Jay Whitehorn, who we know was an artist in New York City in the mid to late 19th century. And there's I don't remember if it's a label or like an old piece of masking tape that says picked up May 1958. And who was it picked up from, or what address was it picked up from? We did not bother to write down. And we have incoming receipts in our registrar's office, which date back to 1964, which should be a receipt of everything that comes into the building, but they don't go back to 1958, so right, we couldn't go back to there and look for more information. Sometimes if we have, sometimes things have an address on the back that say picked up from, you know, blah, blah, East Avenue, and I can go back to the city directories for that era and see who lived there. But since we don't know an address this was picked up from, we can't even do that. So he's unidentified for the moment.
We do know the year, though, correct? 1878. Yep.
Okay. 73, I think.
Oh, 73, you're right. 1873, sorry. What kind of assumptions can we make about the subject of this painting based on that era? Other than that he was probably upper class, what else might we know about him? just based on that?
You know, there's a good chance that there was a portrait of his wife, if he had one. There often would be in pairs. Beyond that, I don't know much more. I mean, I know that James Whitehorn, the artist, or at least who we believe is to be the artist, does have work in other collections. He not only did these sort of large-scale oil portraits, but he also did little miniature watercolor on ivory portraits, which I think are very fine and beautiful, the ones that I've seen. Actually, the Met has a couple copies. And so, yeah, you did have to, you know, have some money to bring James Whitehorn. But was he the best portraitist of the time? I don't think so. I mean, just looking at this painting, it's has its charm.
He's got a great haircut.
Seen it. He's got
check out the pictures on the Twitter feed. I'm Mac Media, or the Mag is also tweeting these pictures as we're talking about them.
And we, you know, we do have a lot of other 19th century American portraits very similar to this that I would say are superior in terms of quality. So when we do start thinking about whether or not this is going to be for our collection, that's what we'll be thinking about. What are the other examples of portraits from this period that we have? Maybe we know who the sitters are. They're sort of better examples or in better condition. We'll be thinking about those kinds of things.
What do you think is the future of this item? What will happen to this painting?
Well, we hope somebody will find him. Maybe he'll be reunited with his descendants. You know, I do think it's interesting what you were saying about sort of the sadness of not knowing who he is. And the reason why people get portraits painted, I assume, I've never had one painted myself, but is that quest for immortality, right? Is to be remembered and to be noticed and to be known. And then to have their names be separated from their portraits, is there is a certain sadness to it. So, hey, if we could find his descendant here today, that would be wonderful.
And what have we learned? Always write things on the back of pictures.
Why not? Exactly. Why wouldn't you include that?
Well, I remember I was telling you, Carrie, when we were looking at that portrait, my grandmother died in 2016, and she was 100 and a half. And so she had pictures, black and white photos, very delicate, from the early 1900s that were from her family. And for the most part, she was great about writing things on the back. But we found a pile of them recently, and there's nothing there. And it's the same thing. It's so sad to think that
these
were part
people?
Of my family, that and I will never know who they are.
That's right.
And no one will ever know who they are because everyone who knew them is gone.
Right.
So
yeah, I'm kind of crazy about doing that now because I'm a historian. So I've been frustrated about that. And so now I always write the names on the back of photos and
I
dates,
do too.
The
I
years
do too.
As well.
Mm-hmm. And now we're not even printing photos either. They're all
on our
phones.
I know, that makes me even more nervous.
What's going to happen to us?
That terrifies me, actually, everything online.
This is becoming a dystopian conversation. Let's talk about some of the other items, the other mystery items. But before we go through the list here, what stands out to each of you? Nancy, what's your favorite mystery item that you've come across?
I think there's a sort of group of objects that are textiles. And I'm really excited because we just got a grant from the Institute for Museum and Library Services to survey our entire textile collection. And it's because textiles are kind of by nature secret. They're rolled, you can't really handle them very often. So we'll be looking at them all and we'll be trying to match these up. But there are a few textiles that don't have an accession number sewn on them. You don't really write accession numbers on those, you actually sew. And so I'm really excited about that because we have some very beautiful work and I'm hoping that we figure it out. So that would be my favorite group.
Jess, how about you?
We have a whole group of World War I posters, American posters, that I just have a soft spot for those posters. They're so graphic and they have so much character. We have a good collection within the museum already of many of these posters that are in duplicate, that are in great shape. And but I love those posters. It was really before in World War II, the posters were not as strong. It was lots of lithographers doing these really strong designs, like Charles Dana Gibson and great American illustrators like that, making these pitches for why we should be going to war and supporting the war. And just the images are really fantastic.
What do some of them look like? I wish I had some pictures of them.
Gosh, you know, they're such interesting, like, sort of snapshots of the moment in terms of cultural history. There are all of these wonderful images of, like, the Gibson girl. Do you know what the Gibson girl is? She was this, like, sassy...
Like
1890s female. You know, she would wear trousers and ride bicycles kind of thing. But she was also very like sexy and alluring. And so Charles Dana Gibson was an American illustrator who created the Gibson Girl, which was really an icon of the period. And he would use figures like that to be like, well, boys, it's time to go to war, you know, and she'd be like wearing a cute little uniform, that sort of thing. So, you know, gender history and cultural history and all of that is wrapped up in these really graphic, beautiful images.
Are the posters that are part of the collection on display if people wanted to look at those?
They are online.
Oh, they're online. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you could search our website. And, you know, you can really go to our website and search our collection. We have nearly everything of interest online. So you could probably type in a poster and see what comes up in our search database.
Great. Carrie, are there items that stand out to you? You're the closest to them, it seems.
I really like the easel. There's a sort of late 1800s Eastlake style big black floor easel that turned up in storage that is just the kind of thing I would put in my house if I had room for a huge floor easel. And I've seen photos of it in our archives with like signs on it at department meetings where they're talking about upcoming exhibitions and stuff. So I think I saw it in a room where they were having a meeting about a French turn of the century exhibition, which makes me think it was something they brought in sort of as an exhibition prop for that exhibition. But I think it's a very cool thing.
What do we know about it?
Not a thing. Hmm. It was
that seems to be your theme.
That, yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. That exhibition was in the 80s, mm-hmm. I think, like the early 80s. And so we know it's been in storage since then. But where it came from before then, don't know.
Well, let's talk about some of the other mystery items that are sitting in the queue for Carrie to figure out. The study drawing for How the Lion Became King. Let's talk about that.
It's a little black ink drawing by Oliver Herford, who was a children's book illustrator. Through just Googling his name, a lot of the books that he illustrated are on Google Books, and so you can page through them and look for the illustration. And so I found the book where it was published later, where that illustration was reproduced, so we know a date that the drawing was made, but we don't know when it might have come to the mag.
And that date was 1905?
05, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't turn up in any of our incoming receipts or in any of our donor files or in art committee minutes that it was ever presented for anything. But I know we have had exhibitions of children's book illustrations in the past, and I can't say what it might have come in for, but
and
that's
on the
that's one where we know some specific information about it, and still searching all the places we might search have turned up no results. So,
but there's something on the back to indicate that at one point it had been.
I think that's from when it was reproduced for the book.
Oh, okay.
I think it's like publication notes about size and scale and, you know, black and white.
But it looks like it had been mounted or something at some
point. Yeah, it has spots of old adhesive at the corners on the back where it must have been mounted to a board or in an album or something.
So I'm looking at the picture right now, and it's a lion, and he looks like he's reading from a paper. He's got his paw on a big rock, and there's a monkey sitting in front of the rock. And it looks like he's addressing a group of animals. There's a giraffe and a hippo, tortoise, it looks like, a few other animals. Do we know anything about this story?
I know that Oliver Herford did quite a lot of talking animals. I can say that much. Do you remember what the title of it is?
How the Lion Became King. I think it's maybe a poem that Oliver Herford wrote as well and then illustrated. I may be wrong about that, but it's all online. So if anyone were so inclined, Oliver Herford, How the Lion Became King, I believe the poem is available online as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's Herford, listeners.
That's
Oliver
right.
Herford. Mm-hmm. Also in the collection of mystery items, there's an 1840 engraving by American artist John Sartain, thank mm-hmm. you, of George Washington and his family. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that.
You know, it's a wonderful engraving. It's a portrait of George Washington and his family. It is an engraving by Sartain after Savage, I think, is the artist who maybe created the original image. And, you know, actually, it's the photo that it's the work that I'm holding in the DNC article. So if anyone's looking up that article online, you could see the image of that print. And it's a really cool historic artifact. I mean, it's, you know, our one of our founding fathers, essentially, and the condition of it has some issues. You know, it definitely, if we do decide, if it ends up being, you know, no one claims it, I would certainly consider it for our collection, but it does have some condition issues that we would need to look at. So, you know, when we talk about condition issues, when we talk about conservation, we don't have a conservator on staff at MAG. We rely on a whole host of really great conservators in different areas of expertise in the region and outside of the region. But every time we send something to be conserved, it costs money. And we have limited funds for conservation. So every time we make a choice about conservation, it has to be in line with our institutional priorities. So would this John Sartain print be a priority for conservation? I don't know. I'd have to make that determination down the road. But
well, I think a lot of times things are, you know, things can jump the queue if, for example, there's going to be an exhibition.
Right.
There are times that we've had works, well, that are in the collection that people want to borrow from other institutions, and that other institution will actually split the cost with us for conservation so they can borrow it. So there are ways, but for a print, I've had prints conserved before that are going to be part of an exhibition, so we are able to push them up the line a mm-hmm. little bit. So that would be one reason. Another reason is that if it's not conserved, it's going to deteriorate quickly, and we can stop that process. So need plays into it as well, not just exhibition.
Right. If there's sort of, you know, sometimes with these old prints, they might be mounted to an acidic board, in which case that it will slowly continue to do more damage to the object. And that's something that we really want to intervene with as soon as we can. There are other kind of condition issues that are more static and can wait.
What kind of conservation work do you think this engraving needs, just based on looking at it quickly?
You know, a curator has a great deal of different expertise than a conservator. And we can look at things and make sort of our judgment, but we always rely on the expertise of a conservator because they're going to bring it to their lab. They have it. They're looking at it with all of their equipment, and they can do little tests, and they will tell us things that we never could have dreamed that we would see in the work of art. So we always rely on.
Or something, you know, and it's funny, sometimes you think something is, you know, irreparable or irredeemable, and they're like, well, no, you just do X. And then sometimes right. you think it just needs a little work, and it turns out it's, you know, a $15,000, you know, right. job. And so, yeah. You know, it all, not always, but a lot of it does come back to funding.
Mm-hmm.
So,
there's also an Egyptian mummy mask, which is labeled with a T item, and that's something that David Andriotta wrote about in his column. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's very large, so it's cataloged as a mummy mask, but it's not the size of your standard mummy mask.
I think he wrote 17 inches by 11 inches.
Yeah,
it's got a big sort of headdress thing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And
it's made of wood. Right. It's carved like a face with a, you know, in three dimensions with a nose and everything. But unfortunately, it has been examined by scholars. Two or three scholars over the years who have said that it has nothing to do with Egypt or mummies, and it's made kind of as a, like, it's more of a modern interpretation, possibly, you know, for tourists.
Oh, well, that's disappointing. When you find things out that you aren't expecting, are you disappointed sometimes? Do you wish it had been something different? I'm sure you probably come across those instances.
No, I mean, every opinion from a scholar gives us more information to work with.
Well, and scholars can have different opinions, too.
Definitely.
I mean, we have many years of, you know, scholars who will come in and look at our collection, and that's wonderful. We really do rely on a great deal of generosity from different folks who happen to be coming to town for whatever reason. We say, will you look at our collection with us? And always they say yes. They love it. They love going into storage and seeing these things. And then we benefit from them looking at these materials and really giving their specific area of expertise to us. But sometimes they do differ in their opinion. So you might get somebody who came in the 60s to look at this African mask and say one thing, and then in the 70s you get somebody else come through with an entirely different opinion. So we're always thinking about that too. We're really weighing, hoping, you know, if we're going to make a decision about something, it's always best to get a couple different opinions.
It's an emotional roller coaster for you over. Jeez.
It is. Thank you for appreciating that.
But those success stories, like we talked about, that writing chest in the beginning, that must make it so worthwhile. So despite all of these objects in there, I hope I hope for your sake and the community's sake and the people who own these objects, for their sake, that we're able to get some answers to all the questions that we have.
Us too.
We hope so too.
Yeah.
So if people do have questions for all of you, what's the best way to contact the Meg?
They can email me at, will it be on, you can put it on your Twitter.
Yes.
At kshaubert@mag.rochester.edu, or they can call me at 276-8982.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining me today. Thanks for all the great information and for sharing your items with us. Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. Great feedback on Twitter. Our thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, Tiana Mignon, my colleague, helping us out on phones today. I want to thank Mike Black for helping us out yesterday as well. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you tomorrow.